prepare for a truth revolution.
Actually, you can't prove God exists.
Questioning tradition, because what you've been taught isn't always true.
The truth will set you free. Truth Revolution, where we contend that you don't have to get rid of your brain in order to have a little bit of faith.
That's right. We say where faith and reason meet. I like that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a good meeting. A meeting I'd want to go to.
Right. Faith and reason shake hands right there.
All right. So today we're talking about whether or not the New Testament Gospels, mm-hmm. which is the stuff about Jesus
right.
and his life, whether they are historically reliable or not, which is kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal, because if they're not reliable, then our faith is kind of placed in the wrong place.
That's right. If the authors of the Gospels were lying or are incorrect about all sorts of historical events, mm-hmm. then we have no idea whether they were right or accurate about the life of Jesus Christ, actually.
Right.
So, you know, that's why we're talking about this. And there's a lot of critics that will come out and say the Gospels have tons of historical errors. They will say that the Gospels of Jesus are full of fanciful miracles, mm-hmm. falsehoods, lies, all sorts of stuff like that. And so, you know, we kind of want to answer this. We want to look at history and see, does archaeology, does historical evidence show that the Gospels are true, mm-hmm. that there's even a semblance of evidence there.
Is there also not a group of Christians, people that call themselves Christians, that believe that Jesus did not perform miracles?
Well, I don't know if it's they would call themselves Christians. You know, there's definitely a group called the Jesus Seminar.
Okay.
And this group is insane. I'm sorry. They're just crazy. They call themselves scholars, but mm-hmm. if you acted like this in any other discipline, you wouldn't be called a scholar.
Okay.
What they do is they get together and they look at a passage in the Bible, and it says something, you know, okay, Jesus walked on water. Mm-hmm. And then what they do is they all get together and they say, well, do we think this could really happen? Could a person really walk on water? And they all take like a marble, and if they believe it was true, I don't remember what the actual colors are, but if they believe it was true, they drop a blue marble in the bag. If they believe it was something that couldn't actually happen, they drop a black marble, and they count the marbles. And of course, you know, well, normal people can't walk on water, so obviously Jesus couldn't either.
We polled 1,000 people. We decided that Jesus could not walk on water.
Yeah, it's just like... Oh, it's aggravating, because mm-hmm. if Jesus was who he claimed to be, walking on water is not a problem at all.
Right.
Now, if he was just a guy, then that's a serious problem.
Exactly.
The question isn't, did Jesus walk on water? The question is, was Jesus who he claimed to be? You know?
And if he was who he claimed to be, well, then walking on water is pretty much a moot point.
That's right. So, but that's why we want to talk about the historical mm-hmm. reliability of the Gospels this morning, and probably next week as well, because we want to see, did the people... The guys' names are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Mm-hmm.
Did these four guys who wrote the books corresponding to their name, did they record accurately what happened? Mm-hmm. Or are they making stuff up?
Mm-hmm. Eyewitness stuff, actually.
Right.
So
that's what we're going to find out. Hey, if you want to know more about the show, truthrevolution.tv.
All right.
You can send in questions. You can send in comments. You can send in love letters to Dave. He's single.
Oh, stop!
But not to me. I'm married. So anyway, but no, you can check out truthrevolution.tv. And,
you're a jerk.
Check out our old shows, stuff like that. We've mm-hmm. been getting a lot of hits on there lately, actually.
Yeah.
So it's kind of neat. People have been checking them out, using mm-hmm. them, talking about them.
And you know what you can also do on the website?
What?
You can donate.
Yes, you can. It costs a lot of money to run this show.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do it every single week.
These chairs aren't free, people.
And and besides the show, we have the ads that run mm-hmm. that talk about Jesus and things like that. And so, you know, if you find the show valuable,
mm-hmm.
We would ask that you just consider donating.
Yeah, just consider it.
You know, whether it's $100 a month or $5 a month, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It would just show that you're here to sponsor the show. You right. want to, you care about this being on the air, and you want to see it here in the long term.
Because we can't keep doing this forever on the budget we got now.
Amen to that, brother. All right. So anyway, we don't want to talk about money all day, but you know, right. if you do feel like this is something that you find valuable, maybe you can sponsor it. So either call Revolution Church or mm-hmm. head over to truthrevolution.tv, and you can grab our contact information there. Mm-hmm. All right. So historical reliability of the Gospels, Dave. The goal is to find out, are the Gospels reliable historically, because biblical critics often argue the scriptures cannot be used as a history book, but I'm going to argue against that in one sense.
Okay.
I'm going to say that it can be used as a history book. Now, I want to state that with some level of trepidation. I don't mean you can use it as a history book, like take it into your history class at school and sit down and say, okay, students, today we're going to learn about Caesar, and your Bible tells us everything we need to know. That's not what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Okay. Your Bible is not a history book in the traditional sense. It's not a book that you should use to study history, but it is a historically reliable book. And so in that sense, we can say it's full of history, and it's reliable. That's what I'm going to argue. Gary Habermas, who is a biblical scholar, he said this: some scholars think that the Gospels are poor records, dominated not by historical concerns, but written as religious propaganda for the purpose of communicating a particular message. Well, that's not true, okay? Not totally true.
Right.
Here's what's important. The Bible contains a wealth of reliable historical information which can, and indeed should, be used as the primary reliable historical information relating to the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Okay, so it is religious, but it's not just religious concepts. It's historical information proving that the religion is true. Okay, these were written as history books, as information relating to what actually happened, what events took place, to keep track of it.
Well, let's be sure that, you know, our history books are written by people who eyewitness history, correct?
Sometimes.
I mean,
not always.
If nobody saw stuff happen,
yeah,
then it's not in the history books.
Well, no, that's true. I'm just saying, you know, the guy who wrote your history book in eighth grade might not have been there during the Civil War.
Okay, I understand that. But the thing that we have recorded in our history books, people actually saw those things happen. And it's not so much different from
Gospels. Your history book in the eighth grade was written by a guy who read an account by someone who was actually at the Civil War.
Wow.
Okay, so, but the Bible...
That means the Gospels are even more reliable.
The Gospels were the actual guys who were there. Mm-hmm. They actually witnessed the event, and that's what we have. And so that it's important. Anyone studying historical documents can only know the opinion or the subjective beliefs of the writer rather than the objective truth about the event. Now, that's what some people say, okay? I'm not saying that.
Right.
Some people say, okay, anyone, if you read a historical document, all you know is the perspective of that writer. You never know what really happened.
Right.
I'm going to disagree with that. Okay, as Norman Geisler points out, this is only true if the definition of objective means that a writer must objectively know everything.
Right.
I mean, if the meaning of objective simply refers to the writer's fair but revisable presentation, I'm quoting him now, fair but revisable presentation that reasonable men and women should accept, end quote, then we can clearly look into history and confidently know what actually occurred with a suitable amount of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're not asking Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John to know every single thing about every event in the history of the world,
right,
or even those events. We're asking them to be able to relate to us what they saw Jesus do with a fair amount of accuracy.
It's actually a legal document.
Kind of.
Yeah. It's a witness report.
It's a witness report. That's right. And the Gospels are different than each other.
Mm-hmm.
They don't contradict. That's what we talk about every week. But they're different than each other. But this difference shows that it wasn't just some script that they all followed.
Right.
It wasn't like Matthew and John sat down and said, hey, when that lady came, what did she say?
Right.
Was it this? Yeah. No. She said like this.
Let's be honest. If they were actually like that, the same, and they said the same exact things,
mm-hmm,
I think you'd have more reason to be a little bit leery about whether they were true or not.
Absolutely. And critics will be pouncing all over that. Mm-hmm. Hey, you have four different accounts of the gospel by four different, quote, people. Right, they're exactly the same. Yeah. Well, and now, of course, they're not exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So people are like, oh, you got four different accounts, they're not exactly the same.
So it just goes to show you that people are going to be opposing it no matter what.
Yeah, what we want to ask, and I don't mean to make fun of people who say that, but what we want to ask is, look, do each of these accounts line up with each other?
Uh-huh.
And most importantly, what we're talking about today is, do they line up with history?
Right.
Do they say, hey, there was a census taken in the year 22 BC and there was 800 billion people in the town of Jerusalem? You're like,
wow.
No, I'm sorry, that's not true. Or do they have something accurate historically?
Right.
So that's For instance, let's get into some of the evidence here, okay, David?
All right. Give me some evidence.
All right. The Augustine taxes and census. I love this one. Luke chapter 2, it says that there was a census taken of the entire Roman world around the time of Jesus' birth.
Okay.
You may remember that because you were there.
I'm not that old.
You read it. All right. The census was issued by Caesar Augustus and took place while, it says, Quirinius was governor of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, I want you to remember that, okay? Quirinius was governor of Syria.
Okay.
Additionally, Luke mentions that each person went to his hometown to register. Now, does this match with what is known about history?
Oh, well, I hope so.
We're about to find out. Are you ready to find out?
Teach me.
All right. An ancient Latin inscription called the Titulus Venetus indicates that a census took place in Syria and Judea about A.D. 5 or 6, so the year 5 or 6, and that it was typical of those held through the Roman Empire from the time of Augustus, which was 23 B.C., to 4 A.D. Now, there's a little problem there, right?
Okay.
What's the problem?
Well, the problem that 4 A.D. was...
Quirinius was done at 4 A.D.
Okay.
But there was a census at A.D. 5. And Jesus wasn't born at A.D. 5, was he?
Well, I mean,
Jesus was born BC. He was born in like anywhere, you know, 1 to 5 BC.
Okay.
So here we have the census. What history is telling us is that the census was not taken the same time as Jesus was born, which is what the book of Luke told us.
Okay.
Now, so
you're scaring me, Jeff.
I want you to be scared a little bit because this is what people see. They see this little piece of evidence right here and they go, "Oh, see, the Bible's not true."
Yeah.
All right. But, you know, given the date that most scholars agree upon for Jesus' birth, 2 to 3 BC, we see the date of the birth doesn't match that of the known census. Now,
right.
Here, let me give you a quote here. Quote, it is quite likely that Luke's meaning is that censuses were taken throughout the empire at different times, and Augustus started this process. We present the present tense that Luke uses points strongly towards understanding that this was a repeated event. So, we note that good evidence exists that this was an actual census that Luke was referring to.
Okay.
One scholar here is saying, no, I just think Quirinius started the process. So, you know, we got to talk about that. We got to figure that out. However, it's known that Quirinius was made governor, and here's the part that I like, was made governor of Syria in A.D. 6, again, okay? He was the governor of Syria in A.D. 6, mm-hmm. not in A.D. 4 when the census was, and certainly we know for sure that he wasn't, or that he was made governor in A.D. 6. Jesus was born 3 B.C. This is like an even bigger problem.
Yeah. Because it's more separate.
Yeah, don't worry, I'm going to figure this out for you.
Thank
okay,
you.
Are you ready? All right, the archaeologist Sir William Ramsay discovered several inscriptions that indicated Quirinius was governor of Syria on two different accounts.
Really?
Yeah, two different times. And so the first time was several years before, which could have made him govern during the time of Jesus' birth. Just like the book of Luke says. Now, critics will point out that bits and pieces of historical information reveal that other people were governed during this time. But a number of different types of joint rule were often employed in the ancient world. And historians believe that Quirinius was a military leader during that time. So when we consider that Luke uses the Greek word, I'm not even going to say it right here, but a specific Greek word for the word governor, meaning he doesn't use a specific governor. He means a general term of leadership.
Okay.
He was, Quirinius was some kind of leader. Then we can be extremely confident that he was some kind of leader about the same time. Furthermore, an Egyptian papyrus dating from AD 104 demonstrates it was actually common for people to return to their hometown for a census. If we consider how often censuses were taken, the date of rule of Quirinius, the census taxation directly prior to the one recorded in 4 AD would be dated somewhere between, check it out, 10 and 4 BC.
Okay.
And Quirinius was a leader in the time. So you put all the historical pieces together and wow, it's like
puzzle pieces come together.
Yeah, at first you see, oh no, it's supposed to be like there was an... Jesus was born like 3 BC, mm-hmm. but the census was 4 AD, and Quirinius was governor during 4 AD.
Yeah.
Well, don't worry. Quirinius was a leader, 3 BC, and there was possibly a census taken then as well.
Right. And if you don't have all the facts, of course, things are going to get confusing.
Right. And that was a little confusing. There was a lot of numbers being thrown around, mm-hmm. stuff like that. But the main thing we need to remember is that there is good historical information. We have got so much more information here, people. It's disgusting.
It's not really disgusting. He's kind of playing it up.
I'm going to try to get through a lot more of this when we come back. And, of course, we're going to be doing it next week, looking at the evidence as well. We got historians. We got all sorts of stuff. Check us out, truthrevolution.tv. if you're interested in donating, hit us up there as well. Support the show. And, you know, we'll come back right after this break and continue talking about historical proof that the Gospels are real. Okay? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, not fabrications, but they are the real deal. Check us out after this.
Truth Revolution.
And welcome back. It is Truth Revolution. I'm Dave, and with me is Jeff.
Good morning. We're talking about the Gospels and whether or not they're reliable historically. We kind of spent some complicated moments there talking about...
It was.
...about ancient governors and censuses and taxes and years and dates and... I'm about to get a little less complicated. That was
good.
That was a little complicated.
That made my brain hurt a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you're trying to do math in your head, and it's like, well, carry the X and the census plus three. All right. So anyway, were the Gospels historically reliable? Because if Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, these guys who wrote books in the Bible about Jesus, if they were inaccurate on even small things, how do we know they were accurate about the big things like Jesus? So... we want to know if they were accurate historically. And I'm going to pull you back to Johann ben Hagalga. All right? This is a...
What?
I pronounced it probably wrong. I don't really know how to pronounce that stuff very well. But there was a dude named Johann ben Hagalga.
Okay.
In 1968... What year were you born?
67, stop.
I'm just checking. All right. So when Dave was 1 year old, about 35 ancient bodies were found in a burial site.
Okay.
Were you mad that I brought that up?
No. just keep talking.
He calls me a spring chicken. He thinks I'm a lot younger than him. I suppose I am. Anyways, I'm sorry. Okay, we're just going to historical Bible reliability, not time to make fun of Dave. All right. In 1968, about 35 ancient bodies were found in a burial site, and the site was dated about 70 AD.
Okay, where was the burial site at?
In the East.
Okay.
In the Near East.
All right.
During an uprising, this was dated about 70 AD during an uprising of the Jewish population.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these people had suffered some violent deaths in this mass grave, okay? The most interesting thing was that this young man, Johann ben Hagalga, his name was written in Aramaic on his ossuary, which is where they hold the bones and stuff. Dr. Haas, a pathologist at the Hebrew University, noted that preliminary data regarding Johann's skeleton indicates he was a victim of crucifixion. Now, this is interesting because... the Bible describes a lot about the crucifixion of Jesus. And if it was wrong about the crucifixion of Jesus and how he was crucified and how he died, then how do you know they were even accurate at all?
Right.
I mean, maybe they just made this whole thing up about Jesus being killed and, you know, raising from the dead, blah, blah, blah. But let's see what actually happened to crucifixion victims. And the studies show that what was found on this guy matches almost exactly what was written in the New Testament. For example, a 7-inch nail was driven through both of his feet. The feet had been turned outward, so a square nail could be hammered through the heel just inside the Achilles tendon. I mean, almost exactly the same as crucifixion pictures.
Right.
And it's funny because that's not even noted in detail in the Gospels, but the way it's described, you can imagine that, and that's how all the painters historically have painted it.
Right.
Not all of them, but most of them. And so, additionally... we know that his lower arms had been pierced with nails, okay? Now, by the way, you might say, well, the Bible says that Jesus' hands were pierced.
I know the answer to that.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Was it not that the Hebrew people actually spoke, when they spoke of the hand, they spoke of the wrist as well?
Yeah, basically, that's like that whole general unit from the top of your finger down to like a little bit below your wrist. Like, that's just... kind of the hand area.
Right.
You know, they didn't like say, okay, here's your palm, here's your finger, here's your wrist. It was just kind of, that was just the hand.
Yeah. And it's your general hand.
Yeah, that's just how it works. So that's not a big deal. That's exactly describing what happened to this other guy too. So he had the nails exactly in the feet the right way. He had the nails exactly in his arms the right way. The nails were the length, what we would expect. And that his legs had been crushed by a blow, fitting the description of John 19 given in the New Testament for crucifixions.
That's brutal.
I mean, in John 19, it describes how people, how the soldiers would smash people's legs mm-hmm. to break their legs. Do you know why they did that?
So that they couldn't actually push themselves up with their legs in order to be able to breathe.
That's
because,
right.
They it actually facilitated a quicker death.
Yeah, you, on a crucifixion, you don't die from bleeding. You don't. You die from asphyxiation. Mm-hmm. You can't breathe anymore. Your lungs fill with water.
Right.
And so if you can't push yourself up to take that breath, you're going to die a lot quicker.
Right.
And so they would break these guys' legs. They couldn't lift up. At least that's what the Bible had been describing. And people didn't know if it was true or not. It seems like kind of fantastical. But sure enough, they find some ancient people who had been crucified, and their legs were broken. So Dr. Haas's study of this has been criticized by researchers just such as Jay Zias and Issa Kelly's. They argue, well, there's no sufficient evidence to indicate that nails pierced the forearms or that the ankles are broken during the process of crucifixion. These wounds would present evidence that seems to reveal that the victim was crucified. These wounds were part of the process,
right,
just like the Bible describes.
Right.
You know, you got these scholars out there saying, well, the Bible's wrong. You know, people weren't crucified like that. We don't think so. That's just cruel and unusual. And, well, then you dig up skeletons, you find.
Well, the Romans were cruel and unusual.
Actually, cruel and fairly usual back then.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, I mean, anything else would be an amazing coincidence, right?
Right.
The fact that these guys discover these skeletons that have the exact same wounds as described as the biblical crucifixion. The crucifixion process recorded in the Gospels has been at least partially corroborated by this story. So that's kind of neat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So far, we've found out that a date of the census was exactly right. We found out that the crucifixions were very, very spot on in terms of what happened to people during crucifixions.
Right.
So, yeah,
right,
that's pretty
good. Let's kind of get away from that a little bit. We haven't done our Bible contradiction yet.
Yeah.
Let's do Bible contradiction. Bible contradiction time.
Okay. All right.
All right.
I'm ready. Let's bring it.
Bible contradiction today
actually
contradicts God and what he said.
What?
Yes. Check this out.
Come on.
Ezekiel 18:20 says, the Son will not share the guilt of the Father, nor will the Father share the guilt of the Son.
Okay.
However, in Exodus 25, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Punish the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation.
All right.
A little bit of disparity there in the concepts.
Okay, so Ezekiel says the son will share in the guilt, and Exodus says God will not make the son share in the guilt.
No, it's the other way around.
What? Oh, it's the other.
Yeah.
Oh, all right, sorry. Exodus says, I see there, I was doing mistake number 20, read my Bible.
There you go.
Whatever it was. All right, so one of them says that God won't punish children for the sin of their fathers. The other one says God will.
Right.
All right. This is cool, Dave. I like this one. Mistake number 6 on Geisler's list of Bible contradictions. I'm going to say Geisler and Pipo's list, because that's mine too.
The Geisler-Pipo list.
Basing a teaching on an obscure passage. Okay, you can pull up in your Bible, find some weird little quote from somewhere,
uh-huh,
and base a whole teaching around this, right? And you would find all sorts of crazy stuff, you know?
Right. And people do it all the time, actually.
People do it all the time. You know, it says, yeah, I can find a Bible verse where it says, put your hands on the horns of a bull. Okay, everybody! New religion! Bull horning!
We're bringing the bulls in.
I mean,
ready with the hands.
Yeah. I mean, so, and that's what they're doing here with Exodus 25. I, Lord, am a jealous God, punishing children to the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. They're,
uh-huh,
they're basically saying, look, this is a good teaching. You need to teach this. God punishes from generation to generation.
Right.
That's not what this passage was trying to teach.
Okay.
All right. This also goes with mistake number 14, neglecting to note that the Bible uses different literary devices. Sometimes the Bible uses figures of speech. It's not a mistake for a biblical writer to use a figure of speech. It's a mistake to take that speech literally. Okay.
Right.
Now, let me read to you Exodus 20, you know, without... let's read it in context and
okay,
see if you can figure out what
okay
was trying to go on. I, the Lord, am a jealous God, punishing children for the sin of their fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments.
Oh.
You see, he's trying to make an analogy there.
Yeah.
You hate me, it's going to be bad for you and probably even
right
for your kids, but if you love me, I want to show love to you for 1,000 generations. He's just trying to show his love is way
mm-hmm
bigger than his hate.
Right.
All right. Now, you also look at Ezekiel. Let's read that in context, because Ezekiel wasn't simply saying, Okay, guys, you're not going to share in the guilt of your father anymore. Ezekiel says this, chapter 18, verses 2 and 4. He goes, what do you people mean by quoting this proverb about the land of Israel? The fathers eat sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. Meaning, if the father's punished, the children is too.
Right.
Child are too. He says, as surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, you will, listen, no longer quote this proverb in Israel. For every living soul belongs to me, the father as well as the son. Both alike belong to me. The soul who sins is the one who will die. You see, he's saying, you used to say this. It used to be that a son was punished for his father's sin, right. But no more. Ezekiel 18, he continues, suppose this son has who sees all the sins his father commits, and though he sees them, he does not do such things, he will not die for his father's sins. He will surely live. So he's saying, look, even if it was this way in the past, where a son was punished for his father's sins, it's not how it's going to be anymore.
Right.
But that's not even what it was. I mean, the Exodus passage was just a figure of speech right. To show that God's love was greater than his hate. So that's the answer for a Bible contradiction today.
Bible contradiction.
Wow. I actually thought we had it. I thought we had the Bible contradiction there, but...
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not that I'm actively searching, but...
Yes, you are. I know you. Okay. Wow, we are running short. We only got a couple minutes left. So next week, definitely, we're going to talk about Tacitus, Suetonius, Thallus, these ancient historians.
Right.
I want to give you one more piece of information today, okay? The book of John, chapter 5, says Jesus arrived at a pool named Bethsaida. And he greets a certain man who receives a healing from Jesus. Now, in John chapter 9, Jesus instructs a man who's receiving a healing to wash in the pools of Siloam. What's interesting here is, you know, hey, what are these pools? You know,
right.
Pools of Siloam, Bethsaida. I mean, these things aren't real. We don't find any historical archaeological evidence about this. But the existence of the pools of Bethsaida and Siloam can be identified with certainty due to archaeological discoveries. Did you know this?
I did not.
They made some discoveries and they realized, wow, these pools are real things. They actually exist, just like the New Testament describes. While neither of these things prove much in the way of Jesus' life,
right.
They lend credibility towards the gospel writer's claims.
Right.
They're not making up the names of pools. They're not making up the dates of censuses. They're not making up the way people were punished. Everything they're saying is historically accurate.
Right, and just like when you're in a courtroom, when the lawyer tries to tear down the credibility of a witness,
yeah.
That's exactly what this is. This is lending the credibility to the witness that is in the gospel.
Yeah, I like that analogy of the courtroom because... You know, if you can show that the guy on the stand was telling the lie about what time he got home,
right.
He's probably telling the lie about him being innocent.
Right.
So it's the same deal. We know that the Bible writers here have been telling the truth about all these little details. Big ones, little ones, and so there's a good chance they were telling the truth about Jesus, too.
Right.
We haven't found any problems historically. Now, hey, check us out, truthrevolution.tv. We're going to talk about this next week. We're going to look at some Greek historians, non-Christian historians from about the same time as Jesus,
right.
And see what they wrote about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Truthrevolution.tv. If you can donate, we would appreciate it. Keep the show going. Check us out at Revolution Church. We start at 10:15, so
yep.
Not too far away.
About 15 minutes from
Go
now.
Go to truthrevolution.tv. We'll see you here next week as we continue historical reliability of the Gospels. I appreciate your listening. Check us out, truthrevolution.tv.